fitting and proper to do this if you choose to. Much of the benefit that we have enjoyed in medical knowledge has been derived from doctors through the years working on cadavers that were given. It's in most places illegal to sell a human body, and so if they're going to have cadavers to work on, these need to be given freely. And what usually is done then, the corpse is immersed in formaldehyde for a certain period of time so that it will stay around long enough for the cadaver to be worked on and learned from by the medical students. How else are we going to train our doctors? Again, if it's wrong to do that, then it's wrong regardless of what the consequences are to medicine. I don't see any reason to believe that it's wrong. I think that that's an honorable thing to do. But these decisions are very personal, and we ought to let it be a Romans 14 issue. The death of a loved one, the many decisions that are attendant to it, is emotional enough without having to debate the method of dissolution at the time of the death. It's good in a family if these things can be discussed long before somebody dies, that this can be put in writing in a place where everybody knows where it is. You know, Franklin Roosevelt left his will as to what should be done with his remains in his personal safe where nobody could find it until a long time after his funeral. So you need to leave this, make sure people know about it, and leave it, and be sure that it's understood. Don't spring something on them after they're gone, and maybe even after your funeral is over. The ancient Egyptians, as I have said, believed that the eternal existence of the soul was linked to the existence of the body. So they built pyramids to preserve the bodies of their pharaohs for a long time. But God doesn't need man's help to preserve our bodies for eternal life. We don't have to be freed from the body by fire, as the Hindus say. We don't have to have our corpse preserved in mummified form, as the ancient Egyptians thought. It's a separate issue apart from the disposition of the body. We can be sure, as Peter put it in 2 Peter chapter 3, that in the great day comes, when the elements melt with a fervent heat, and when there is a great noise and the heavens are rolled up as a scroll, you will be found of Him. 2 Peter chapter 3. You will be found of Him. It doesn't matter what happened to your body. You, personally, never will be anybody but you always will be you. You're stuck with your personal identity from here on. You're always going to be you. And you will be found of Him. Peter says, what manner of persons ought we to be? Let us live in such a way that we can be found of Him in peace. He shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto His glorious body, according to the working whereby He is able even to subdue all things unto Himself. In closing, if you make the decision for cremation, you need to be very careful about this and be sure that it's what you want to do. One of the criticisms that has been raised against cremation is the fact that once a body is cremated, all the forensic evidence that may have shown crime is then gone. It's an interesting thing to me that Napoleon, in his will, dictated that his body be cremated. The next of kin wouldn't hear of it, and so Napoleon's body was interred on St. Helena, where he'd been exiled. And then later on, his body was transferred to Paris. Well, in recent years, through medical science, we have found ways, by looking at the hair of the human body, to determine the proportion of poisons like arsenic that are in the system. The hair of Napoleon has been looked into in just these last few years, and it's determined that there's no question he was killed by poisoning on St. Helena, where he'd been exiled. It always had been a question how a vigorous man in his 50s suddenly took sick and died the way he did. But that's what happened to Napoleon. We wouldn't have known that if his will had been enacted, that his body be cremated. So there is a lot to consider here. It's a big step to take. And it needs your personal consideration. Your family needs to know your personal desires. They, of course, will make the final decision after you're gone. There's room for a variety of ways of disposing of human bodies. It has nothing to do with God's design for our future, when He shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto His glorious body. by the working that He Himself is able to bring about through His mighty power. If you're outside of Jesus Christ today, you will face a future in hell if you continue in the way you're in. You will not be found of Him in the condition you want to be in. We're going to conclude by extending an invitation, which is going to allow you one more opportunity, and perhaps your last opportunity, to accept Jesus Christ at His own words and in His own terms. To take the gift of that blood that dripped out of His body, that was shed for many for the remission of sins, and to allow this to be applied to your heart, so that you have the Holy Spirit come and reside in you as the earnest of your inheritance, so that you someday will have this new glorified body of which we speak. Without Him, there is no hope, and you are without hope and without God in the world if you're outside of Christ today. Anybody subject to the invitation, let us know what we can do for you as we stand together and sing the number that's going to be led. Everywhere we look among the peoples of the world, we see a dazzling array of skin color, hair type, facial features, and stature. We must add to this the great diversity of culture and the many languages. We understand that with the technological advances we have now, we've been able to have people survive at the South Pole for an amazing period of time. We have lived at the peaks of the Himalayas with technological help, and even out in space beyond the earth itself. Even before we had these marvels of technology, as human beings, we have occupied the remotest of islands and the driest of deserts. We have lived in the coldest steppes in the mountain areas. We have been able to colonize this planet almost virtually in every portion of its occupiable area. It's difficult to imagine any other creature that has been living in so many different places on this earth. Although we must give the cockroach its due, man has survived virtually everywhere. Now, for all of these differences among ourselves, we constitute one single biological species. Men and women with roots in different continents are able to meet and marry and have healthy families produced among them. So there is a unity. And it's a unity that frustrates any attempt to parcel out the world's populations into distinct subspecies, as often as people have tried this. We do perceive a great diversity among ourselves because our brain is so constituted as to allow us to see patterns. And we see different shapes of people, different varieties of people in color and otherwise. We see a few of these things in our own physical appearance. But many more of these things we see as we look at them only on a cellular or a molecular level, that there are a great amount of variations in our genetic code. One person may have a resistance to a particular variety of disease, for instance. Somebody else is able to digest milk, even though they are an adult. There are all sorts of variations genetically that come into play with making us physically the kinds of people that we are. Subtle differences that cause us, you and I, to stand out as individuals within a group. Our similarities identify us with humanity as a whole at the same time. The first question I was asked to deal with tonight, and there were two questions, two parts to this. I hope to deal with both of them. But the first one to deal with, it has to do with where did the different races of human beings come from? Where did they come from? How did these differences arise? Now, Rudyard Kipling wrote a series of stories called Just So Stories, in which he imagined different ways to explain the way things have gotten to be the way that they are now. In Aesop's Fables, you see some of the same things. There's a parable told, and it has a moral to it, and maybe it explains how a fox or some other animal got to be the way that it is now. We could spin all sorts of tales trying to explain why the different peoples are the way that they are. We could invent a story for why the Scandinavians became tall, for instance, and another story for why those same people became light-skinned. The idea here is to take a Darwinian sort of approach How does a particular trait that is had by a certain group of people enhance their survival? Or how does this particular trait that is had by a certain group of people cause them to have more offspring, which in turn can produce more offspring that have this same trait? There is this assumption also that it takes a tremendous amount of time for human variation to become evident as evolution works at a steady and at a snail's pace. So how do we deal with these kinds of issues? Evolutionists assume, generally, that humans diverged from each other racially at about the same rate that we diverged from the chimpanzees, which are supposed to be our closest relative. On the time issue, it would take so much time to produce the differences that we see in human populations. So what about this question of time? I hope to deal with this more in just a few minutes. Right now, though, let's talk a little bit about color. The difference we tend to notice most between ourselves is the coloration of the skin, also the hair, and often the irises of the eyes. There is this pigment of the hair and the skin and the eyes called melanin that plays the role of making us different colors. It also plays a role in protecting the skin from the ultraviolet rays that can be so harmful to it. It explains why exposure to the sun affects light-skinned people a lot more than it affects dark-skinned people, because exposure to the sun increases melanin, which is what causes tanning. Our coloration depends on the number of black and white alleles that were passed down to us from our parents. Children inherit these genes independently of the other characteristics. For instance, the difference between straight or curly hair is a completely different characteristic than the color of the skin. This is the reason why you take an albino who is Papuan and he looks completely different from an albino who is Scottish, even though they're both albinos, because this is just one little piece of information in the genetic code having to do with skin colors. There's almost a half a dozen genes that have a significant effect upon pigmentations. These genes reside in the nucleus of every cell of your body, and yet they express themselves only in one place, in the specialized skin cells that have a monopoly on melanin production. Now, we all possess the essential ingredients for making melanin and for making great amounts of it. All of us could be black. All of us could be brown. We have the capacity for producing this amount of melanin. The only exception to that are people who are albinos, and I doubt that we have any here. Albinos are very rare. Some of you may never have even seen one. I had the privilege of going to school with two albinos all through school. One of them was in the same exact class that I was. He was in my first grade room, in fact. That was my first exposure to being around an albino. His hair was as dazzlingly snow white as anybody who is here tonight. He had no pigmentation in his skin whatsoever, and his eyes had very little coloration. What was there appeared to be a kind of a mild purple. His name was Bernie Ackley, and I can remember that well because he did burn. When he'd go outside for recess on a hot day, we noticed in first grade that his name fit with the way he was, because in a 15-minute recess, he'd be getting red. He'd just burn. There was nothing there to turn this away. So this is a very rare thing, and it's kind of in a category by itself. It is a genetic thing. We look at the Asian population of people. They have an extra thick layer of something called keratin, which produces the yellow brownish color of their skin. There are little tiny genetic changes that account for the rainbow of human coloration. When we look at the way this happens at the genetic level, how these minute things cause these things, it makes us wonder if our obsession with skin color doesn't seem to be blown out of proportion quite a lot. There are 40% of the people in equatorial Africa who carry an abnormal hemoglobin gene that deforms red blood cells into a crescent or a sickle shape. This is where sickle cell anemia comes from. Usually, it's all right because they'll just have none or one of these cells, and the good cell will conquer the bad one. The good gene will conquer the bad one. If you have two of these, though, that are together, then you will not live a very long life unless you have access to good medical treatment. How do these types of things come about? How did this come about in that particular population so that 40% of the people in equatorial Africa carry this abnormal gene, and a great many of them have two of them? What accounts for these things? Now, for most variations, that give human populations their distinctive characteristics, it's really difficult for us to know just exactly what forces have been at work to cause these things to occur. And that's the reason we have so many of these just-so type stories. We used to think that the pygmy in South Africa was short because food was scarce. He didn't have enough food to eat to grow very tall. But then we found out that the pygmies actually have normal levels of growth hormone within them, but they have a genetic defect that prevents their bodies from using the hormones to its fullest extent. So what happened there to the pygmy? Did nature select this mutation because it offered survival advantages of some sort? Or did this characteristic arise just as a result of random variation? And how can you find the answer to that? The trouble with natural selection, and I think it does operate in the peoples of the world to some extent, but the trouble with natural selection is that there seem to be so many, many exceptions to the rules of natural selection. Take the Japanese, for instance. Japanese teenagers today are considerably taller than their grandparents ever thought about being. The difference is a matter of improving diet. It's not a matter of genetics. For hundreds of years, the people of Japan have survived without nature selecting mutations for smaller stature. So how do we know that a scarce food supply was responsible for the survival of the growth-limiting changes in the pygmy then, going back to these people? The list of just-so stories that we tend to invent is just endless. Why are the Inuit people relatively short and bulky? Well, the story always was this helps them to retain the heat, and they need to retain the heat. But then why are some groups in Africa relatively tall and slender? Well, because this helps them lose heat, it has always been said. But in each one of these cases, you can find at least a dozen exceptions to the rule we've drawn up. What about those tall people who have survived very well in the cold areas of the world, like the Dutch people? And what about the short people who have done just fine in the hot areas, again, like the pygmies? If it's true that African people have less hair in order to stay cooler, as some have suggested, then how is it that the Asians have done so well in the cold climates when they also have relatively little hair on their bodies? Asians also have an extra layer of skin on the upper eyelids that causes their eyes to have that peculiar Asian look. So we could spin another story about how it was something to do with the wind or something to do with the snow reflecting the sunlight that caused them to develop eyes in this way. But then we have to ask, were individuals who had this extra fold of skin, were they really that much more likely to survive than those people who lacked this extra fold of skin? This is what we face when we investigate the area of skin color. We talk about the strong sunlight of the tropics and the protective powers of melanin and how natural selection may have built that up over time in Africa, and you can make a point about that. Skin cancer is deadly. It's something that afflicts the light-skinned peoples of the world much more so than the dark-skinned people. And not only that, but light-skinned people who spend a lot of time in strong sunlight, like the people from European descent, who go down and live in the sunny climates in Australia or in New Zealand or in Hawaii, they suffer the highest rates of skin cancer in the world. Cab drivers get it more than people who work inside of office buildings all day. And cab drivers get it more on this arm than they do on this arm because they're driving with this arm and this is the arm sticking out the window. It's definitely connected to the exposure to the sun. So we just don't explain what has happened here. Why didn't the African people move out of the tropical zones, for instance? They could have moved north. Why did they stay where they were? Now, it's true. If you look at European history and the peoples that are indigenous there, you go south of Europe, across the Mediterranean Sea, down into Africa, go down to the equator of Africa at that point on the globe, then we do have dark-skinned people, black-skinned people there at that point on the globe. That's perfectly true. And then you go across the Mediterranean, you come to Italy and Greece, and the people are getting a little lighter skin. You go up to Germany and France, we're getting lighter. You get up to Scandinavia, what's happening? As you go from the equator northward, hair color is getting blonder, eye color is getting bluer, and skin color is getting lighter. That's perfectly true and has often been pointed out. The trouble is, you just move partway around the world and come over here to the Americas, and you have something that doesn't fit with that at all. We have dark-skinned people, indigenous, clear up in Alaska, where it's cold, and all the way down through the Native American peoples on this continent, all the way down to the equator, on down through South America, and clear on down to the tip of South America at Tierra del Fuego, where it's cold again. Dark-skinned people all the way. So how do you explain these things? There has to be something besides natural selection, even though I think natural selection has had some impact on human history, but it seems to be inadequate by itself to adequately explain a good portion of the variations that exist between different human populations. So if natural selection has played a more minor role in human history, then how do we explain the great range of features that we can observe among ourselves? Well, there are a number of attempts to explain this. One has to do with the so-called founder effect, and I think this is a legitimate observation. We see this most often in small, isolated communities that have an unusually high incidence of inherited and rare diseases, because those are the groups that we tend to study. And they have been able to trace the patient's ancestries back to a single couple, or at least a small group of close relatives who are called the founders. We've done this with the French Canadians in eastern Quebec. Small pioneering groups, early marriages, big families, isolation to keep them separate from everybody else, and we can study there in a microcosm a little bit of how these things are passed on, a little bit of how the human genetic works in real life. You can see this with the Dunkers in Pennsylvania. Go to Franklin County, Pennsylvania, and see these German Baptist people there, the Dunkers. Their religious customs required them to be culturally different. They dressed in a way that was unusual for everybody else. They were required to marry within their community. And many of the surviving members are descended from just 50 families that immigrated from Germany in the early 1700s. The frequencies of the blood types and the other genetic traits among the Dunkers differ from the frequencies that are featured in the United States and German populations as a whole. It seems unlikely that there was any selective force at work in the sense of natural selection that was in operation to favor the survival of Dunkers who had blood type A as opposed to some other blood type. We can't talk about natural selection there. Rather, we're talking about something that seems to have happened purely by chance. An unusually high proportion of people with blood group A were in the founding population of the Dunkers. And so we have something besides natural selection operating here. We have the idea of the founding group and the genetics of that founding group being passed down. We have the concept of so-called genetic drift, where we have an immigrating group that carries with it a certain unique set of characteristics, and then by definition, since they have left where they were, the group they left behind doesn't have that same set of characteristics. So we have a drift away from those characteristics, and over here where they went, there's a drift toward those same characteristics. The Ashkenazic Jews, for instance, who moved eastward out of Germany in the 17th century, were isolated culturally from all surrounding populations. Several of them inherited a number of rare diseases, which afflict this group at very high rates. This is the type of thing we're talking about. One of the great forms, and important biblically forms, I believe, of genetic drift has to do with so-called population bottlenecks. A population bottleneck occurs when you have a tragedy or calamity of some sort, a war or an epidemic, some sort of a catastrophic occurrence that wipes out all but a small part of the original population. For instance, you could have a flood that would come in and drown almost everybody in an entire tribe except for just a fortunate few, maybe except for even just one extended family. And then these survivors bequeath their genetic characteristics to subsequent generations, which become that tribe. Everybody in that tribe from then on has the genetic characteristics of those people who were at the crux of the population bottleneck. These survivors, they just pass on everything that they had within them. If there's a high degree of relatedness among these survivors, then their descendants may begin to appear quite different physically from their neighboring peoples round about them, even if some of those neighboring peoples live relatively close. Well, the greatest population bottleneck of all time, of course, was the great flood of Noah. There we have the population of the earth back down to just 8 people. Everybody on earth is descended from just Noah's 3 sons and their wives. So this is the greatest population bottleneck of all time. There's another thing that enters in here, and it has to do with the selection of mates and the way we as human populations do this. Some of us are very quick to point out that we have differences with our mates, and that's obviously true. It is common among us to say that opposites attract, and there's truth in that. But I think that, humanly speaking, the Beach Boys knew better that we tend to pick people who are like us. They were a singing group from California who sang, "I wish they all could be California girls." And I think this is the way we usually do select our mates as a people. Underneath the superficial differences, there lie the grand similarities. Not always, but more often than not, we tend to marry somebody who grew up nearby, who speaks the same language as we do, who belongs to the same cultural and religious and social or even political groups that we do. And the result of this is a barrier that exists between groups of neighboring peoples who may live cheek and jowl by one another, and yet they're different from each other because they tend to marry within the group. Now, back to that question, where did the races come from? The Bible doesn't say where the races of human beings came from. Theories about this have abounded. I'll deal with just quickly maybe, I don't know whether to go back to Noah's prophecy or not. Maybe I better do that. I don't think I'll even deal with the where did Cain get his wife issue, and some people have thought that maybe different races sprang out of that. I don't think so at all. I think Cain just married his sister at the time before the gene pools were polluted and before this was a taboo, and that has nothing to do with anything. All those descendants died in the flood anyhow. But we're talking about people on the earth today. What about Noah's prophecy in Genesis chapter 9? Maybe we ought to deal with that just for a minute, if only to dispel the idea that has often come from it. Noah prophesied on the future of Shem and Canaan, who was one of Ham's sons, and also on the future of Japheth in Genesis 9, 25 through 27. I'm not going to take the time to read that. I think you're familiar with it. The 10th chapter of the book of Genesis gives us the table of nations, which follows with a list of people that were descended from these patriarchs. Now, ever since the age of exploration, back about the 15th century, European scholars have been tempted to associate these three lines of descent with the major, so-called major racial groups in the world, the Asians, the Africans, and the Indo-Europeans, as they're often called today, or as they were called when I was a boy, the Mongoloids, Negroids, and Caucasoids. The line of reasoning has gone like this, and I want to do this very quickly because I don't think this is even right, but I'm trying to disabuse our minds of it if any of us believe it. The line of reasoning went like this. Number one, Ham means black. Number two, Africans are black-skinned. Number three, therefore, Africans must be Hamites. Number four, Noah prophesied that Ham was going to be a servant of servants. Number five, servant of servants means slave, and therefore, the Hamites would have to be slaves. Therefore, the Africans would have to be slaves in their future. That's, in a nutshell, the way the argument went. And the result of that, of course, in the thinking of many people, was that Europeans had a God-given right to enslave and to exploit the African peoples. Now, this goes to show how an argument can be based on fallacies, how it fails on factual grounds, and in this case, it's the facts of the Bible that it fails on. First of all, like many proper names in the Bible, the word Ham, the name Ham, has no obvious meaning. The Hebrew word may have had something to do with warmth or with heat. It's used poetically of Egypt in Psalm 78, verse 51. But the word itself suggests nothing about skin color whatsoever. Secondly, the expression servant of servants there may have meant that he was the greatest servant of all. More likely than that, it meant a servant of other servants, but there's certainly no proof for the idea of slavery involved in this. People who make this sort of argument generally have a point to prove before they ever start making up the argument. And that's, I believe, what happened here. To justify things like South African apartheid, to justify American slavery. Interestingly, and I'll just say one more thing about this, of all Ham's sons, only Cush, in the 10th chapter of Genesis, is associated with the Negroid peoples. In this case, it was the Nubian people of northeast Africa. And even then, we see that Cush became the father of Nimrod, and it was Nimrod that founded the non-black nations of Babel and Assyria. Genesis 10, verses 10 and 11. Mizraim, another son that's mentioned here, is the Hebrew name for Egypt. Genesis 50, verse 11. And, of course, from Canaan came the Canaanites. African nations may have come from Ham, but Ham does not mean African. And when you look back at history and you see that both the Romans and then the Vikings enslaved other Europeans, then the whole idea is that it is trying to be supported by this argument is just shot. The range of Ham's descendants gives us good reason for rejecting any attempt to make the three sons of Noah match arbitrary divisions of the races. The Table of Nations was given apparently for the purpose, among other things perhaps, but for the purpose of showing the people of Judaism, of showing the people who followed Moses out of Egypt, they needed to know why God blessed Shem and Japheth and why he cursed Canaan. They needed to know that the promised land was going to belong to them and that they were supposed to go in and take it, and it was not supposed to belong to the descendants of Canaan. And they were told why it wasn't. The land itself vomiteth out its inhabitants. The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full, but it's going to be full later on. So Abraham was told that even in his time. So that was one of the purposes of the Table of Nations. I don't think that that prophecy in Genesis 9 has anything to do with where the races came from, and even if it did, it would basically explain black and white, but what about other races in the world? What is the biblical view of this? I need to hasten on here. Evolutionists often argue that creationists don't have an explanation for the human diversity that we see around us. That's unavailable to anybody who adopts a literal view of the Bible. They may reason that creationists don't have any access to this kind of change in the short period of time that we believe the human race has existed. There is a common misunderstanding about this, and I'm amazed how often we run into this misunderstanding. The idea that creationists object to all kinds of evolution, and that's not true. We never have objected to that. We don't object to microevolution, just variation within a species or even within a kind. I don't know of anybody who objects to that. We've seen living examples of that. What we're objecting to is macroevolution, which is a highly problematic theological idea based on uniformitarianism and all of that. But we need to account, when we're talking about racial characteristics, for variation only on a small scale and only within a single species. So we're just dealing with a little thing here, really. I believe, to make a long story short, that the key biblical event comes in Genesis 11 at the time of the Tower of Babel and the confusion of the tongues there. Up to this point, we've got these three lines of descent living in close proximity to each other. But in Genesis 11, God gives them different languages so they can't work on the tower together, Genesis 11, 7, and then God scatters them abroad. That's in the 8th verse of Genesis 11. We can't be sure on what basis this partitioning occurred. In the Table of Nations in Genesis chapter 10, each line of descent appears by family and language according to their lands and nations. It seems most likely, therefore, that the division occurred by the principal family units. In other words, that people in family units were able to talk the same language and understand each other, that it wasn't just random, you couldn't understand your parents' language and so forth. It seems to have been divided by the family units that were present at the time of this confusion and dispersion. This corresponds to the time of Peleg, and we're told in verse 25 of Genesis 10 that it was in his day that the earth was divided. It was divided by language at that point. It may have even at that point, and I'm not sure about this, but it may possibly have even been divided somewhat geographically at that point as well. There had to be some time that the continents got to the places where they are now. And I'm not sure about that. It may be at the time of the flood that there was just a lot more water, so you developed more continents and islands than you had before, because when the water was lower, that you had land chains across there. I don't know which way that happened. We know that continental drift has occurred, and we don't know all about that we'd like to know. But in some way, the earth was divided in Peleg's day, even if it was only on the basis of what we read about in Genesis 11. So, if at that point the human population spread over the face of the earth, and we know that it did according to the Bible, then we have here a sudden outpouring of founder groups everywhere. You see what I mean? A sudden outpouring of population bottlenecks. They're all coming from this one place, and they're just founder groups, and they're put in different portions every place. Each extended family is isolated from other groups by language, and it carries its own set of genes then out into the world, and from within these groups, then they're developed the peoples of the world as we have them on the earth today. And so it's more of a random type thing than having to develop a bunch of just-so stories to figure out why somebody's black or why somebody's white. It has to do with the original founding groups more than any other one thing, and the particular genetic code that they carried into the world, as well as any mutations that occurred over that time. And by the way, since we're talking here about time, This is of an issue for the Christian who believes in a young earth that the Bible talks about. I don't believe that time for this needs to be a problem. First, let me show you what the problem is and how grave the problem is when it comes to the issue of time. If we put the flood back where the Bible puts it, in the 1657th year following creation, that's about 4,350 years ago, round numbers. So we go back to 4,350 years back from where we are right now. When did we start having noticeable differences in skin color on the earth? Well, if we can go by ancient art, if that's any kind of a clue at all, and surely it would be, why would ancient artists be drawing pictures, painting pictures of people who were different colors if people of different colors didn't exist at that time? We go back even as far as Abraham's day, and we see that their artwork shows people of light skin, people of dark skin, people of different colors. Well, when did Abraham live? Maybe around 1950 B.C. In other words, about 3,950 years ago. So if the flood is 4,350 ago and Abraham is 3,950 ago, that's only 400 years from the flood to develop these differences in coloration. So from that point of view, the problem looks even worse than we thought maybe it was going to be. Well, how do we explain this? One of the ways we can explain this, I believe, has to do with dealing with the extent of the variation that it takes to get from one kind of skin to another kind of skin. It's only, the commonly cited figure for this is 0.2%. In other words, if you were to compare your DNA as it exists in your body right now with the DNA of any stranger picked randomly from anywhere on the face of the earth, compare your personal DNA with the DNA of any stranger picked randomly from anywhere on the face of the earth, you would find that two pairs in every 1,000 pairs are different on the average. Now, there are around 3 billion pairs in human DNA, so 0.2 of that figure would equal about 6 million pairs. 6 million of these pairs would have to be different. What does that mean? All we need are sufficient mutations to make these 6 billion pairs different. And then we can explain what has made us what has been responsible for making us appear different to the people in other places in the world. In the case of skin color, this can mean just a handful of mutations among just a very few genes. Still, though, 6 million mutations in such a short period of time, or say 400 years, that requires some explanation. I believe that one solution to this may lie in the possibility that there were much higher mutation rates going on than we have previously believed. Most estimates have rested on clocks which have rested on evolutionary assumptions. And evolutionary assumptions get us in trouble everywhere we look, everywhere we try to look at the ancient past. Until recently, we haven't had any real good evidence about this. We've just had assumptions that were made and then extrapolated back about the rate of mutations occurring. But the situation has improved for us recently when geneticists were able to analyze DNA from individuals with well-established family trees going back several generations. One study found that mutation rates in the DNA were 18 times higher than previous estimates had placed them. And that's a very interesting number because, and I'm not going to do the math all through the map, but just to give you the bottom line on this, if this new rate that was 18 times higher than the old assumed rate, this new rate is from evidence that is empirical. It's not an assumption. It's empirical evidence based on a study. 18 times higher than the previous estimate. If you take this new rate and you apply it to the mitochondrial Eve, now you know who I'm talking about? The ones that people look back and try to say that, well, there was a theoretical Eve back at some point and all human beings are descended from her. If you take this new mutation rate that's 18 times higher than the old assumption and you apply it to this mitochondrial Eve, then it would turn out, believe it or not, that this hypothetical woman, Eve, existed 6,000 years ago. Now, I don't know of any anthropologist yet who believes that, but that's what this would show, using this new rate that's 18 times higher based on empirical evidence versus the old assumption that we had. So I think things seem to be at least moving in the right direction here, in a biblical direction. This new data may put a biblical model in closer reach for a lot of people. Now the Bible tells us that God has made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth. The founding groups moved out from the Tower of Babel. They were all of one blood. They were all descended from Adam and Eve. They were all descended from Noah and his wife. But they moved out from the Tower of Babel, and these founding groups had different gene pools, and I think that's where these variations that we see, along with some degree of natural selection over time through the environment that the people lived in, that these have contributed to. But we're all made of one blood. In the third chapter of the Galatian letter, we're told that with reference to our inheritance in Christ, there is neither Jew nor Gentile. That's amplified in the Colossian letter, chapter 3, where he talks there about neither Jew nor Gentile. There is neither barbarian, Scythian, bond nor free. For we are all one in Christ. We're all one. There is no difference in human beings insofar as race is concerned. God is interested in one race of people, and that's the human race. There is no difference other than these superficial genetic things, and that shouldn't come into play in our thinking in the church at all. The church should be God's rainbow coalition. That's exactly what the Lord built it to be, to bring together in one all things in heaven and earth, in one, to show how to break down walls between peoples as they've grown up in the selfish, proud world, and to be together. Red, yellow, brown, black, and white, they're all precious in God's sight. God has placed us in the church together. We ought to function and cooperate within the church together. We're dealing now with the second question. How do we as the church implement God's plan in the church and as Christians when we are among the different races of the world? By treating each other like human beings. By dealing with each other on the basis of our common paternity in and fatherhood that comes from God. And disregarding any prejudices that may have been passed down through us in our families or elsewhere. He has made of one blood, and we ought to think of each other in exactly that way. For some of you, this comes very easy. I trust for most of you that it does. If in your background you have something that keeps this from coming easy for you, if it is a problem for you, then it's something you definitely need to work on. I was asked specifically, and this was not in the questions that were passed on to me by the assignment that I was given from here, but today somebody asked me about interracial marriage, so I want to just touch on that for a moment. I do not believe that there's anything in the Bible that condemns interracial marriage. It's often pointed out that the Israelites were to marry only of their own nation. When we bring that to our time, of course, that God's nation today is the church. The true Israel now is the church. And so the argument from the Old Testament then is an argument for marrying in the Lord's church, but it's not an argument against interracial marriage. I believe that people of different races have a right to marry one another. I have often said that in different places where you may be, this can be sociologically a real problem for you. In some places, it's virtually sociological suicide to interracially marry, just because of the way the people in the population around you will react to this. So that needs to be taken into consideration. But biblically, scripturally, and Christianly, interracial marriage is perfectly legitimate. And we have to be honest about this, I think, that usually the time that the ideas of interracial marriage bothers any of us very much, it's between black and white. When somebody who's of Caucasian descent marries somebody of Asian descent, we don't see the jaws dropping and the gasping of breath the way we do when black and white marry. Why is that true in our country? I believe it's because of the slavery issue and the dilemmas that we have stupidly created for ourselves on this issue in the past. But that has nothing to do with what God said in the Bible. We have to take everything into account. I've pointed out to your own young people that they need to consider everything about this. When you marry, it's good. If you are of different races, this is something that can be an impediment for you because of the way other people will be looking at this. And that is something to consider. It takes more than love to make it all right and wise to marry. So you have to consider this. But scripturally, I know of nothing against interracial marriage. And you know what? Regardless of what interracial couples have to put up with out in the world, in the workplace, or in the neighborhoods where they live, the church that God established should be a haven for interracial couples. They ought to be able to come to the family of God and be looked at there in a Christian way, as God views people. And so, and I've known of cases where this was exactly the situation, and people have said, you know, it's only when I come here that I can really relax, because I know that here I'm loved, I'm accepted, and everywhere else I'm wondering if somebody is looking over their shoulder at me. So there is all this to consider. And there's probably more that should be said, but I don't even know when I started. I know I've been talking too long, and I know you don't want me to talk as long as I talked last night. I still feel kind of embarrassed about it, although I did not ask your forgiveness, and I'm anxious to hear Richard to see whether you have to give it to me anyway.